The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerkers Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
If Patrick Henry were still alive, he would listen to the Constitution Hour, featuring Professor Kevin Gutzman, debuting every Wednesday at noon Central, here on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
And good afternoon or evening to you. This is the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman.
The constitutional system that the revolution was based on and then was supposed to have established, and the system we live with now.
And, of course, the system we live with now is in no way... It's hard to reconcile the two. As a matter of fact, if you're looking at them from a distance and you didn't know any better, you probably would not suspect that the two were related, would you?
No, I think all that's left of the original constitutional system are various names. It reminds me that in the first decades of the Roman Empire, the first emperor, Augustus, insisted that he had maintained the republic. It was just that he was now Pontifex Maximus for life, consul for life. You know, he held all the high offices for life, and previously the limit had been 1 year in a lifetime. So, yeah, that's kind of what we have now, I think. We have people swearing that they'll uphold the Constitution. We have court decisions that are supposedly in the name of the Constitution. We have congressmen and various talking heads on the radio who call themselves constitutional conservatives, and yet what do we see that has anything in common with the form of government that people like Thomas Jefferson argued for? I'd say, well, we have elections, but of course, in the end, the eminentos from Harvard and Yale law schools on the Supreme Court get to decide whether the results of the elections will actually stand, or they'll just pretend to be upholding them while actually invalidating them. So it's a kind of burlesque of Republican government instead of an actual Republican government.
I don't believe I've ever heard that term before, a kind of burlesque. Most people think of burlesque and they think of that shaving cream commercial back in the from the 1970s with or they think of some club that they tried to sneak into when they were very young. But moving to the topic at hand, on today's Constitution Hour, I thought that we might start today with a question about the big debate tonight. The GOP debate in Iowa is going to be sans candidate Donald Trump. He's not going to show up at the debate. He's decided to punt and to not attend, and will instead host his own event across town for charity, and this is supposed to be broadcast in some form or some shape or form. But the genesis of this is a feud that was between the host, one of the host or moderators of the Fox News debates, and that's journalist Megyn Kelly, and Donald Trump. And it's escalated into Trump saying that he didn't think that he should have to be subjected to a debate where he was going to be questioned by someone that was obviously hostile to him. So he kind of intimated that he might pull out. And then Fox News did the signal duty of basically giving him an excuse to do so by saying that they had checked with world leaders, and they had their undercover sources, I believe, had said that they would treat Donald fairly, and that his legion of Twitter followers would obviously not be part of his cabinet. And with that, then Trump had the impetus to say, oh, okay, so you think it's funny and you want to mock me, and I'm the reason that you're going to have half your ratings, so he's not going to show up. This prompted now an escalation of the feud. There is a bit of a comparison that we can make from 2016 and the turn of the 19th century, in that newspaper man, this gentleman was a newspaper man of Virginia, James Callender, had some, initially, Kevin, he had good dealings with Thomas Jefferson, and then he had not so good dealings with Thomas Jefferson. I realize that television and newspaper printing, where they actually had to use a printing press, are not the same, but it is one media form to another, and it does involve a president or soon-to-be president.
Well, basically, Callender had criticized the Adams administration's foreign policy, and he took various hard knocks for doing that, including being sent to jail and socked with a stiff fine. So when Jefferson came in, Callender made clear to people who knew Jefferson that he expected to be recompensed with a significant office. The one he apparently had his eye on was postmaster in Richmond, Virginia. And ultimately, people like James Madison didn't think that Mr. Callender, who was pretty much a muck-raking journalist, should be given such an important post. And Callender responded by becoming the first guy to publish what apparently had been widely circulating rumors in central Virginia that Thomas Jefferson had a slave woman whom Callender referred to as Dusky Sally, who had had children by Jefferson. And of course, at the time, polite opinion didn't say much about this in public, although there were people who knew Jefferson who appeared to have believed it. I mean, for example, there was a guy named John Hartwell Cock, C-O-C-K-E, who also was the owner of a very large plantation, and like Jefferson, was a liberal political reformer who actually was with Jefferson, one of the founders of the University of Virginia, who wrote later that he was chagrined to see that so many people were having children by their slaves in Virginia. But of course, he said, in light of Mr. Jefferson's example, I guess it's not to be surprised with. So Cock actually made two comments like that in his diary, a big interval. Then it seems obvious that he meant that on his many occasions of having gone to Monticello, he had seen that this rumor was true.
And so Callender published this, and thus began some sort of a feud between Callender and Jefferson, right?
Well, actually, within a pretty short time, Callender was found face down in the James River in Richmond.
I was going to get to that.
people said, well, you know, he was a drunk. It kind of reminds me, when I was in high school in the late 1970s, I lived in Texas, and I did not like them, but it seemed everybody else I knew liked the Dallas Cowboys. And in those days, actually, people may not remember, but CBS was called the Cowboy Broadcasting Service because they just were constantly just excited about the Cowboys. And the halftime commentary on NFL games, invariably, whoever was playing would turn to the Cowboys, and they had a woman named Phyllis George.
I was getting ready to say they hired Miss America, who was Miss Texas, Phyllis George.
And she just drooled over the very thought of the Cowboys. Anyway, so later on she married the governor of Kentucky, actually. And if you're interested, you could find, I'm sure, beautiful photographs of the beautiful First Lady of Kentucky wearing her gigantic Kentucky hat to the Kentucky Derby and so on. But anyway, the reason this came to mind is that I recall one one Sunday, the two guys who were then the two lead football broadcasters for CBS were Pat Summerall and Tom Brookshire, I think. And Brookshire, well, Summerall, of course, was a very successful place kicker in the NFL, and I think Brookshire played cornerback or something.
He did.
Yeah, so anyway, one week...
He was a giant.
Is that right? I thought he also played for the Eagles.
Maybe he wasn't. Oh, he's an Eagle. You're right. He was an Eagle. That's right.
And Summerall played for the Giants. But anyway, one weekend, they were actually broadcasting the Cowboys game, and in those days, you basically got one game, so if you liked football, there you were with those Cowboys again. And I remember there was this game where the Cowboys were barely trailing at the end of the game, and Roger Staubach was their quarterback, and just invariably he would march them down the field and they'd win the game.
That's impressive.
So at one point they called timeout, and Staubach went over to the sideline to talk to their famous coach, Tom Landry, and then when the timeout was ending, Staubach went running out onto the field, and he, as he would usually do, he was holding his hands up by, you know, right in front of his the tops of the numbers on his jersey, as if he had arms as short as those of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? So anyway, Brookshire, seeing this, said, "You know, Pat, Roger runs like a sissy." And I kid you not, that night he was arrested for DWI in Dallas, and he never broadcast another game for CBS. True story. He was on the number one team, and he got fired that day.
Are you saying that there's a connection between...
I am saying that is the reason. I think that's the reason he got arrested for DWI, too. It's in Dallas, man.
Of course, few people were arrested for DUI in the 50s and 60s and 70s. I don't even think they'd invented the term yet.
You know, actually, in Texas, in the 1970s, it was legal to drink and drive as long as you weren't intoxicated.
And the only
way that they'd know you were intoxicated was if they had probable cause to think so. They couldn't just pull you over for having a beer in your hand because that was legal. So
can we go back to 1975?
Yeah, when I was in college in Austin, they actually had a drive-through liquor store about a half mile up the main road from UT's central campus. Brew consumed in Austin, as I observed.
So I observed earlier today that the Tom Brookshire story notwithstanding, that Donald Trump had gotten, amazingly, had gotten the better of Robert. Here, we'll use Cowboys terminology, okay? Of Roger Golden Ailes, right?
Yeah.
Instead of Golden Richards and Golden Ailes. And that if the biggest media bully in the history of the universe, being Ailes and Fox News, was so easily hoodwinked and beaten by Trump, there may actually be something to this. I don't know. This Trump guy may get some things done. As in, wherever there is a deal to be made, and it's sad, and you and I talk about this every week, but in government today, everything is a deal. Would it be so ironic, Kevin, that since we have no constitution system left, basically, that the man that wrote The Art of the Deal would ultimately wind up negotiating the greatest arts of the deal, meaning treaties, meaning budget accords with Congress, meaning, and of course, I'm way ahead of the gun here, but the prospect is now starting to look a little more possible.
Well, I understand Roger Ailes actually is out of commission. I think that it's Rupert Murdoch he's dealing with. I've read that Ailes is under the weather and hasn't been working for weeks now. You said earlier that he probably was going to cost Fox half its ratings for this quote-unquote debate tonight. I bet it's more than that. I can't imagine that they're going to get half the ratings they got with him doing the show. I mean, I think I read that typically these debates would get like 3 million viewers, and they've been getting 22 million. Isn't that right?
Okay,
the worst of them got 11 million, so they still were more than three times baseline.
Yeah, they got for the first one was like $11 million, and for the first one that they did on Fox Business News was $8 million.
Oh, okay.
The first one they did on 17 on CNN was $21 million. The last one they did on Fox was $18 million.
Right.
And the number of concurrent streams, people that were streaming it on the internet. Both networks had set records, Fox at about 800,000 and CNN at about 1.1 million. Only reason I know is because you and I are kind of in the business of streaming media now, so I try to keep up with these sorts of things. So that's the bar for the Constitution Hour to set, 1.1 million concurrent streams. Hey, I think we're up to the task, buddy. I don't know about you. I'm ready. But, yeah, the $20 million would not have been, especially leading up to the first caucus of Saturday, the Iowa caucus, $20 million tonight I think probably would have been doable. The average night on Fox News, though, is somewhere between $3 and $4 million. So I would ponder a guess that there'll be somewhere between $4 and $10. So that's less than half, as you just said. It is quite the show, and even here on the Constitution Hour, we wind up every week somehow working something with the presidential contest into the mix. Another question, you know, and this is my question to you, because I had I actually had this written down last week. I didn't get a chance because we ran out of time. Some of the states have actually placed or have executed legislative initiatives where they're saying, look, the Electoral College, it's bogus, it's BS. Whatever the popular vote of this state says, that's who gets our delegates, okay? I think you and I have talked about this before, and you said, well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that they can't do that, right?
No, there's nothing that constrains the state legislature's decision about whom to give the electoral votes of the state in any way, except that since the 12th Amendment, we've had amendments assuring that people cannot be denied the right to vote on the basis of being female or black or otherwise denied equal protection of the laws.
And so what I was going to get to is, well, the Republican parties that operate in each one of the states, because they have to figure out a way. The GOP cannot have Trump as their nominee. And I was thinking that, well, there's probably nothing also that tells the electors that go to the convention that just because their primaries said that Trump won them, that they have to give Trump their votes at the convention. And this just sets up a I think what's going to wind up being, if some kind of deal isn't brokered twixt now and then, is going to wind up being one of, if not the most harebrained and frenetic conventions in your and my adult lifetime, because quite frankly I can't remember a harebrained convention that either the party has had. I know there's one that's legendary, 1968, for the Democrats, but I was only 6 years old.
Well, 1980 was pretty goofy, too, when they had that talk about Gerald Ford being Reagan's running mate.
Yeah, didn't devolve to the point, though, where there was a question that Reagan was going to be the nominee, though, did
it? No, the question was what it would mean that he was the nominee. Ford wanted to be a kind of co-president.
So there's a lot of we have a lot of things that we could touch on and talk on about the on this, and and we could come back to this subject here, but we have a couple of other things to get to with. This is the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. The show is actually live today. We are recording this, so I am live in the Veritas Radio Network Crusade Channel Studio. Kevin is in his office at Western Connecticut State University. And you can get all the downloads of the Constitution Hour if you are a Founders Pass member, and you'll need that Founders Pass to participate in our chat room and our live coverage of the debate tonight with full audio and commentary, and I hope all of you will make plans to attend. So we have a question that was sent in by a listener, and I thought that that we could tackle this question in a segment. But my young intern and the young lady who answered the phone and who called you actually hit me with a question right before we were getting ready to go on. And she said, do you think you could ask Professor Gutzman to explain to young people like me and others what the difference is between, and she means, I guess, in effect, between the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights, the American Bill of Rights and the Magna Carta. And I said, well, he's going to tell you something about English common law is based on, but I'll let him tell you.
So the question is just what the difference is between the two?
Well, I think she was getting at was the Magna Carta kind of like an English, really early English edition of the Bill of Rights?
Oh, no. Well, what happened in the 13th century was that the English barons were tired of King John's claiming various kinds of arbitrary authority that they understood that he wasn't supposed to claim, with power to seize people's property, power to extend various kinds of taxes, power to declare that women had to marry particular people, and various people had to pay certain fees when they were going to inherit from their lord fathers and so on. And these were all innovations that King John had lit upon because he wanted money to pay for the English government's participation in the Crusades. So ultimately what happened was that at Runnymede in 1215, the English barons essentially gave John a choice between swearing that he would never do any such thing again and being killed. And so he chose to swear that he would never do any such thing again. And, another one of the guarantees there was that none of them would be convicted of crime and punished without respect for the law of the land. This is seen as a kind of precursor of the contemporary American idea of due process. So you can see that this was originally only for the benefit of the barons, who were very few nobles. It wasn't a general statement about the rights of man or something. It wasn't a general statement about the limits of government. It was a statement about the limited authority that the king had over the nobles.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, however, especially from the 16th and 17th centuries with the famous English judge Lord Coke, C-O-K-E, this came to be said to be a kind of birthplace of limited government. So eventually people were going to make false claims that it really stood for the idea that government is limited and that people have individual rights and so on. Not that I'm denigrating that idea or those ideas, but that really wasn't initially what it was about. On the other hand, England did later have what's called the Bill of Rights in 1689. The Parliament insisted that William and Mary, before they could claim the throne of the United Kingdom, had to agree to various limitations on their power and various rights of individuals. So they conceded that they couldn't raise taxes without asking Parliament. They couldn't create new courts without asking Parliament. They had to respect that if you were a member of Parliament speaking in Parliament, you couldn't be punished for what you said in Parliament. Besides those, there were some individual rights like the right of Protestant subjects to keep and bear arms that were also enunciated in the English Bill of Rights. And that time, actually, what you had was, as in the Magna Carta, the king conceding that individuals have particular rights. So it was the king kind of granting these facts. American bills of rights, on the other hand, have usually been the predicate of constitutions. So first came the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and then came the Virginia Constitution of 1776. And Americans have understood not that the king came first and then he granted the people rights, but instead that the rights came first and then people created a government with limitations implied by or expressed in the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, and then there was a, if you want to watch a good film about this, the Paul Giamatti movie, Ironclad. Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
So this takes place, we're talking about King John the First, I believe.
Actually, he's the only King John.
Okay, so after he makes the deal with the barons, he tries to renege on the deal because it's as you just said, and the barons hold themselves up at a castle in, I want to say, Rochester. And there's a siege there that goes on for quite some time. Brian Cox, the English actor, plays one of the barons that's opposed, and Paul Giamatti is King John. It's a very graphic, very violent movie with a lot of cutting off of hands and feet as punishments and sorts. But at the end of the day, King John basically kneecaps the Magna Carta is the movie. It's for a history buff, if you like English history, because based on what you just told me, it sounds mildly accurate. You might enjoy it. Ironclad with Paul Giamatti. So I want to get to our listener question here on the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Goetz, but we'll take a time out and we'll come back and answer that. And the question that that I will ask the professor and that we will endeavor to answer is, how did Madison and Hamilton, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, manage to redefine the purpose of the Philadelphia Convention and persuade the delegates to effectively create an entirely new concept of government for the states? Kevin, hang on to that thought, and we'll be right back with more of the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Goetzman. This is the Constitution Hour. It is live here today on the Veritas Radio Network Crusade channel, and we'll be right back right after this here on Crusade.
The professor is in. Send your questions for Professor Kevin Goetzman to Constitution@VeritasRadioNetwork.com.